cook Cupid. And what a great way to start a Valentine's Day edition of Tenfro is Reading.
Cupid, please hear my cry and let your arrow fly straight to my lover's heart for me.
Welcome to a particularly therapy and as close to romantic Valentine's Day edition of Tennessee Fro is Reading. I'm your host, Felicia Baxter. Listen, I'm going to be reading from the Song of Solomon because, yes, it is Sunday. Yes, it is Valentine's Day. And, yes, everything that I'm going to be reading has some steep in love and romance. I actually have discovered a great author that it is a shame that more people don't know about. And from a genre that more people should be reading. I'm going to be reading An Extraordinary Union, and as well as Be Not Afraid from Alisa Cole. She's been writing and been in the game for almost a couple of decades, but it was through Bridgerton and the English chick, Julia Quinn, that I made the effort to look for someone of similar, but I think of better ilk, because this has to do with us, about the romantic us right here in the United States. And why hasn't, she's written for Shonda, but why couldn't Shonda Rhimes or the Ava DuVernays created a series based in this type of love and black love at that? Oprah, are you listening? And I hope you, and as always, I'm always astounded that people are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks.
That is The Late Great You Send Me by Sam Cooke. How can you have a wonderful special Valentine's Day episode without having Sam Cooke playing in the background, child? I just don't know. And I don't even want to try.
By night on my bed, I sought him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. I will rise now and go about the city, in the streets, and in the broadways. I will seek him whom my soul loveth. I sought him, but I found him not. The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. Have you seen the one my heart loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found the one my heart loves. I held him and would not let him go till I had brought him to my mother's house. In the room of the one who conceived me, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field. Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Who is this coming up from the desert like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it is Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon. His post he made of silver, his base of gold. Its seat was upholstered with purple. its interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. Come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding and the day his heart rejoiced. This goes back into a little bit more if you were to look up the history of this particular book of the Bible. It's part of the Old Testament. Some wonder why it was even included in the Bible. It does have a sensuous kind of nature to it. It's all been attributed primarily to King Solomon, but it is also rumored that an African woman, probably one of his beloved in his harem, actually also co-authored this book, although it was primarily attributed to one of the greatest poets of the Hebrew persuasion. And what a great way to honor the spirit of St. Valentine's Day than reading from the Song of Solomon on this great Sunday. Also, it also proves not only the love between the spiritual, the love between a man and a woman, but also, or whoever your partner, gender your partner is, but it also is an example of the love of God for us. Beautiful words, opulence, and just it. This particular book embodies the celebration of the love of God for his followers. And I'm so great that I had the opportunity to share this with you.
At first I thought it was infatuation, but ooh, it's lasted so long. Now I find myself wanting to marry you and take you home.
Everybody knows this piano riff. This is the late, I think she's still alive though. This is Gloria Gaynor. I Will Survive. And what a way to start this section of the podcast. So, what is my fascination with historical romance all of a sudden? Well, I have made no qualms about it that I have been completely, completely enthralled with the Bridgerton. I like Shonda Rhimes. I like the whole look and feel of what I would consider a masterpiece. And even in spite of its obvious beauty, Bridgerton has been left out of the Golden Globes and the run-up to the Emmys and Oscars for whatever reason. It seems like this was our year to shine. There has been a vast amount of African-American and Black and Brown content for the ages. It seems like it was rich this past year because we've had a lot of notable deaths. But in spite of all of this, it seems like the Academy is hell-bent on using nepotism or whatever, the elitism, or still has managed to whitewash the awards season. But
it doesn't mean that, you know, even with this snub, it's still okay. Well, it's not really okay, but it at least has propelled me to expand my reading. I'll put it that way. I'm not going to watch or an award ceremony that is not representative of what I would actually watch on a big screen if AMC was still open. But I am probably going to continue to buy their stock. I know it means a select few people will continue to get rich, but at the same time, I'm looking forward to the day where we can go back to the movies, but that's neither here nor there. But I'm very glad for people like Shonda Rhimes, not only treating me to great films of epic proportions and expanding my taste or what I'm going to read. So, not really too much of a romance novel person, nor definitely not historical bodice-ripping romance. And I started reading the whole Judith Quinn, who was the original author of the Bridgerton series. However, there are Black women stateside who have been in the game just as long as she has and have been writing our love stories in the historical sense. But no one has taken upon themselves to bring these stories to light. But I'm hopeful with the Ava DuVernay and the Tyler Perrys of it all and the Shonda Rhimes of it all, if they would absolutely take up her cause and give the rest of the audience a treat of epic proportions, because she is basing her characters, although it's on a select group of characters, ex-slaves, runaways, etc. But I think it has the ability to be just, because it's almost, that seemed that Regency or King George III time period, some of these are, especially the reading for this first part of the podcast. But a little bit more about the author, Alisa Cole. She's an award-winning author of historical, contemporary, and sci-fi romance. Her Civil War set espionage romance, which is, I'm thinking, is going to be really cool, and Extraordinary Union is the winner of the American Library Association RUSA Best Romance for 2018. She's contributed, there you go, to publications including Shondaland, The Toast, Vulture, RT Book Reviews, and Heroes and Heartbreakers, and her books have received critical acclaim from the New York Times, Library Journal, Kirkus, Booklist, Jezebel, Vulture, Book Riot, Entertainment Weekly, and various other outlets. When she's not working, she can often be found watching anime with her husband or wrangling the menagerie of her animals. And in this selection, I will be reading from her book, Be Not Afraid. Nevertheless, to the persecution and tyranny of his cruel ministry, we will not tamely submit, appealing to the heaven for justice of our cause. We determine to die or be free. That is the Dr. Joseph Warren. I believe he wrote that in 1774, 1775. He died at Bunker Hill during the early stages of the American Revolution. Chapter 1, August 1776, Brooklyn, New York. Be not afraid. Elijah repeated the words to himself as he squatted in the marshy ditch. What was originally a battle cry, now a command he forced himself to obey. The man who'd first shouted the words and
charged the redcoats at Boston Common had been courageous, but Elijah didn't plan on joining him in the ranks of the dead Patriot Negroes quite yet. He had come close to it that night, though despite his intentions, he gripped the cold metal barrel of his brown vest with one hand. With the other, he pulled out a grimy handkerchief and wiped the blood from the bayonet. The red coat crumpled on the ground beside him and gasped his last breath only a moment before. Elijah held no personal hatred for the Brits. He hadn't pulled away when the ruddy-cheeked man reached for him, fear and desperation in his eyes. Crikey. As his guts spilled out. Elijah had said a quick prayer over the still warm body before searching it for ammunition and rations. He had no qualms about the act. The Continental Army was poorly supplied, and the lobster backs were funded by the Crown. Besides the body-breaking labor, men like him had been born into help line the royal coffers. The petty theft could be seen as a back pay if one looked at things in a certain way. Elijah wasn't sure that was the right mentality. The only thing he knew to be true was that he needed to be free, and no man, Brit or colonist, was going to obstruct this path now that it was a possibility. Then why did he run? Elijah shivered. The late summer night was unseasonably chill, and the wind cut through his shabby uniform, pieced together with other men's cast-offs with ease. His breeches had ripped during his flight from battle, and the cool air gained interest there as well. He pulled at his ill-fitting jacket, too small to button at the front, and wished he were back to Sutton Farm, tending to the horses and their animal warmth. Working with them was the only thing that made him at peace. He shook his head at the indulgent thought. Back at Sutton Farm, you're a slave. And if you don't keep fighting, you'll remain one, Elijah chided himself. He needed to stop reminiscing and find his regiment, what remained of them. The attack on Brooklyn had been expected, given the area's sparse population, but it still caught the Continentals unawares. When a skirmish had started for one shining moment, Elijah thought they might take the day, and then the Brits had fallen upon them like a wave crashing into the shore, scattering the untrained American soldiers like so many particles of sand. One patriot turned tail, and then another, and then fight turned to flight in mass as they sought escape from the onslaught of the red coat regulars. Elijah had been filled with shame as he fled the skirmish, stumbling over the marshy land for who knew how long, but the emotion disappeared when he fell into a ditch and a British soldier tumbled in after him. He was still alive, and the other man wasn't, and there was no shame in that. Unhand me! A common refrain on the battlefield, but the voice that rang out in the still night was much too unusual to go unheeded. An angry, feminine vibrato. Elijah poked his head up, scanning his surroundings. Night had fallen thick, and thick cloud cover obscured the stars, making it hard to see much of anything. He squinted, wondering if he was simply going mad from fear until he saw the ethereal form burst through the mist-laced trees a few feet away from him. She was tall, as tall as him, and clad in a long ivory gown that flowed around her feet as she ran. Now, how in a ham sandwich somebody in a white gown in the middle of a battlefield go disappear out of the blue? See, this is what kind of annoys me about historical fiction. And also, when was Brooklyn established? I'm going to have to look all that up before I publish this. But anyways, I'll probably have the details of that in the podcast notes. A hooded cloak obscured her features. When she stopped and turned, the cloak flapped in the wind, revealing a glint of metal clutched in her hand. Well, hell, she gonna cut his butt. A stocky man with a rifle slung over his shoulder stumbled out of the woods close behind her, out of breath from giving chase. The man's impeccably tailored red coat, fine stockings, and imperious gait advertised that he was a high-ranking officer in His Majesty's Army. "You've caused quite enough trouble tonight, Kate," the man said between huffs. "You'll return to my tent this instant before we end up in the thick of battle." A squabble with a camp follower, Elijah thought with contempt. He must have run further than he thought. He would hunker down until these two took their drama elsewhere and then attempt to find his way back to his fellow Continentals. "I'll be damned if I do that," the woman bit out in a familiar, accented voice. It had the dips and curves of the voices of the older women in the slave quarters, those who had not been born with the shackle linking them to these fledgling colonies. A gust of cold wind whipped across the marsh, knocking the woman's hood back, and Elijah felt a tremor run through him that was entirely unrelated to the weather. Her kinky hair was cut short, exposing smooth, dark skin pulled taut across high cheekbones and a proud forehead. Her eyes were narrow and her full lips stretched into a grimace as she regarded the red coat who approached her. She was gorgeous in her fury. And I am marking that. Let me back. Hold up. Go back. Sharing that. That's what I'm talking about. Share. Notes. See, this is when you actually can do many things on the fly. And the way that Mac, of all things, allows you to be able to utilize different devices and compile things to make them beautiful. And this is a way for me to be able to do this in a very concerted and focused manner with my podcast. But anyways, Kate, Elijah thought, feeling a strange drop of anger at the dull British name likely bestowed upon her by her owners, just as his had been. It no way matched the woman before him. "I was told that if I fled my rebel master and joined with the crown, I'd have my freedom," she said. "There was no mention of bartering my body for the privilege. I will work, but not on my back." Wow. "If you think I traveled this far just to be ravished by some bloody English bastard, you are quite mistaken." "Come now, girl," the man crooned, his voice placating. "Don't act if you're a stranger to a good tupping." "What the hell? If I said I give you a bit of coin, what more do you want?" "So romantic, you Brit," she sneered. "Is that how your father wooed your mother before he rutted with her then?" "You disrespectful bitch," owled the man, grabbed for her. Elijah didn't know if the red coat saw the flash of the knife, but he surely felt its point as the woman drove it into his sternum. Holy crap, I told you she was gonna cut him. The Englishman's face went white with shock, and he clasped the knife with both hands, tumbling to his knees before he could pull it free. The woman, called Kate, stood over him and watched, her face expressionless. She didn't even flinch, Elijah thought. As if she heard him, she suddenly began to shake. It was cold, but not enough to cause the full body tremors that racked the woman as she pulled her cloak close and stared at the dead man at her feet. Elijah knew he should stay where he was and wait for this morbid tableau to come to its logical conclusion with the woman fleeing into the night. So, again, women are lied to and how much further she could have gone, you know what I mean? In the grand scheme of things, if she had been allowed, you know, if she had truly been allowed to go on, and if people would just keep their word, maybe it's that he thought it was basically okay to disrespect and just degrade this woman. But she had one for him, because she sure did plunge whatever knife to the hilt. Because, wait, here we go. Elijah thought, bloody hell, as he pulled himself from the ditch and started for her. His mother had always told him that his heart was bigger than his brain. He stepped on a branch as he approached, and the noise startled her. The clouds had passed, and wan moonlight illuminated her gaze as she turned to face him. Her eyes were filled with fear that made his heart constrict. It made no sense, given the harsh words and deadly action he'd just witnessed, but in that moment, she seemed like something fragile that should be held gently. A newly bloomed rose whose delicate petals might fall apart at the slightest touch despite her sharp thorns. You got that right. Are you all right? He walked toward her with his hands raised. Dealing with the skittish animals was his job. And the woman before him was not so different from a wild mare. One wrong move and she would bolt. He had to proceed with caution lest he alarm her. Her gaze flitted over his body, which he knew was a weapon in itself. A lifetime of plowing and planting and picking had seen to that. She took a step back. I mean you no harm. I saw what the bastard was attempting, and he deserved what he got. She was still trembling, although her dark gaze had sharpened to better scrutinize him. Her face was so expressive that Elijah knew the instant she let a bit of her guard down. A bit was a lot for a woman like her, though he was sure of that. Most of them aren't like that. She pulled at her gown up close. He could see how dirt clung to the tattered hem, how the fabric was worn from too many washings. Most of the soldiers ignore me unless they need me to launder or mend their uniforms. It was such a relief after everything else. But this one, he fixed his attentions on me and he wouldn't look away. I couldn't let it happen again. It will not happen again. There was something entrancing in the warm tones of her voice. It was quiet now, nearly carried away by the winds chasing the clouds through the night sky. But there was no mistaking the strength that undergirded her words. Elijah walked over to the fallen man and began searching him. He'd gotten barely anything from the regular in the ditch, but this man had a fine musket and even a finer revolver, plus a small satchel of coins. He took the weapons and tossed the coin purse to Kate. Her eyes widened in a surprise as she clutched it, but she didn't seem pleased. It was only in that moment that Elijah realized he wanted to please her. I'm going to find my regiment now if you want to come with me. The loyalists scattered us, but I'm sure we're regrouping somewhere. You're fighting with the Continentals? Elijah felt an uncharacteristic surge of pride, but that was quickly crushed under the weight of her next words. Are you daft? Surprise froze him first, and then Elijah's temper flared. Suddenly, he was acutely regretting coming to Kate's aid. He hadn't been wrong in his initial assessment. She was a hard woman. Is it daft to fight for my country? He asked. This is my homeland. I mean to defend it. He believed those words. Believed them with all his heart, despite the way things were now. Things could be different after the colonies were free of taxes meted out by the British. Different for him and everyone else trapped by the bonds of slavery. That he and other motivations or he had other motivations for fighting. A deal struck between master and slave was none of her concern. You speak like a man with book learning. A freedman, perhaps, she guessed, her hand gripping the quorum purse. I bet you grew up in some northern town and have white neighbors who treat you nice. Well, let me remind you, you are a nigger, and your country enslaves niggers. Yet you risk your life to help these men? Yes, I call that quite daft. Elijah's anger was sudden and intense. She thought she knew what he had been through, did she? Maybe he would strip his shirt off and show her how wrong she was. Oh, so the British are great saviors, are they? He asked, annoyed by her icy disapproval and his reaction to it. Says the woman who just killed one of the bastards for trying to molest her. Perhaps you like to ask your brethren down in the islands their opinion. And that's the end of that small sample of Alisa Cole's Be Not Afraid, which I'm going to follow up by readings from the first chapter or even the epilogue of her next series that takes place in the next century of our this country in another conflict from the Civil War. And I'm wondering, because of the slavery connotations, would Shondaland or any other production company would be willing to take on these particular stories? Because I'm taking it on because it's Valentine's Day and this is Black History Month. And why not demonstrate the intricacies of Black love in a time so fraught with fear? I mean, don't we live in those times? But isn't the beauty of love that can blossom even in the most dire of circumstances? So, and there you go. So, that's the late, great Patsy Cline introducing this next section of the podcast, An Extraordinary or Unlikely Love. Again, I am profiling on this Valentine's Day, or this Valentine's Day, this new, well, she's not new, she's just new to me, Alisa Cole. And An Extraordinary Union. And I hope you enjoy the music as well as this section of the podcast.
You'd leave me for somebody new.
So, in this first of a three-part series, also from the before name author, Miss Alisa Cole. I'm speaking the words of Susanna Kearsley from the New York Times, another New York Times bestseller. She says, this is the perfect blend of history, adventure, and heart-stopping romance. With a courageous heroine you will love and a hero you'll fall in love with. This is so Bridgerton is, I wish they had, this had been picked up and been scripted for the series. So here we go in Alisa Cole's 2017, An Extraordinary Union. Prologue, April 1861, Baltimore, Maryland. It will be an easy assignment, a simple passing on of information, one that even a girl such as yourself should be able to handle. Elle suppressed a bitter laugh as she recalled her loyal league master Lavelle's briefing from a few days before. Easy. Either her superior had dreadfully underestimated the Southern male's love of an opportunity to do violence, or he purposefully set her in the middle of danger. She doubted it was the latter, but the man was unduly annoyed at her for having the gall to aid her country without the virtue of certain appendage hanging between her thighs. As if a penis would somehow prove more useful to the cause than her peculiar gift. From what Elle had discerned over the last few months, whatever supposed benefits of the organ conferred were canceled out by the mulishness and a propensity for tomfoolery. The scene around her proved that well enough. Her skin prickled with unease as she watched men stream into Baltimore's Bolton Street Station, egging each other on as they awaited the train carrying those first brave souls to answer Lincoln's call for volunteers after the abomination at Fort Sumter. Hats were pulled low and the rumble of deep voices plotting mischief filled the air. The crowd continued to grow, filling with plug uglies and longshoremen and aristocrats alike, until the air was thick with the smell of tobacco and, unwashed bodies. The possibility of an easy assignment had been trodden under the boots of these scoundrels with hate in their hearts and excitement in their eyes. Elle pressed her head, her back to the wall and hoped the dingy gray frock and head wrap common to slave women would help her blend into the shadows. Gonna give these Yankee bastards a taste of my prick. Oh, Lord. A homely man a few feet away from her said, tossing a small, sharp knife from hand to hand. Something akin to fear shivered down Elle's spine, but true fear was rooted in the unknown. The secessionists of Baltimore had already ripped up the railway tracks and torn down the telegraph lines, cutting off the city from the capital and showing that they meant every threat they uttered. They were plotting death and discord. Elle knew exactly what would happen if any of them suspected the black woman in the corner was in possession of ciphers that, once decoded, would bring many of their ilk before the justice of the Army of the Potomac. Baltimore had a secessionist problem, and Elle was there to solve it, if she wasn't found out first. Her stomach lurched as a man brushed past her and she chastised herself. She survived weeks on the stormy seas during her ill-conceived voyage to and from Liberia the year before. Wow. She should be able to gird her loins a damn sight better than that. Hell, she lost Daniel and survived that too. She felt a wash of heat at her eyes and pushed away the thoughts of her best friend and a rejection in his spun honey gaze the first time she'd seen him. That was the past. She'd experienced a sight more danger than seasickness and men's broken hearts in the last few months. She was a Loyal League woman now. Her gift had gained her entrance into the society of blacks, freed and enslaved alike, with networks across the country funneling as much information to the North as they could gather. It was her quick wit and her quick draw that had ensured her a place as a detective. Cool. Working to prevent utter chaos across the country as it slipped further into disunion. The nation was now embroiled in a war that would either see her people freed or forsaken. Whether Lavelle had downplayed the Baltimore situation was unimportant. This was her first solo assignment, and she refused to give anyone, Union or Confederate, the pleasure of her failure. So this seems like it was maybe the first of its kind, and maybe that ladies' detective agency may have been loosely based on, because it had also, I'm wondering if Harriet Tubman, because of course I just recently watched The Woman They Call Moses recently, and I'm wondering if she was part of this loyal league that operated behind enemy lines to feed information back to the Union. Or vice versa. But anyways, L looked at the large clock face in the central hall of the train station, willing the minute hand to move faster and the train bearing the regiments to arrive. Her target was the Washington Artillery out of Pottsville, Pennsylvania. She sought their manservant, Nick Biddle. While Biddle was seen as a capable aide to the company's captain, like many of her brethren, he was much more than that. He was another who had sworn the four L's: loyalty, legacy, life, and Lincoln. Wow. There was sudden commotion from the swath of men closest to the tunnel. The realization of impending action throbbed through the crowd from one end to the other. Just before the train whistle cried out, announcing its arrival, the men all around L surged forward as if the train emitted some magnetic force on them, drawing hatred to righteousness. L's stomach twisted again and she closed her eyes against the ugly scene before her. Men shouted and showered the train with garbage and rocks. Animal entrails and other waste slammed against the impervious metal with little effect. But inside, there were men made of flesh and bone who would have to march through this madness. Why must it be like this? L suddenly felt small and insignificant in the face of the pure hatred, filling the air around her. She missed her home. She missed her parents. What was her purpose in this fight in which neither side could truly be trusted? She closed her eyes and focused her thoughts inward, taking a deep breath to quell her racing thoughts. She would reach Biddle and relay the message. Crowd be damned, she was no simpering miss. She was Ellen Burns, and she was going to help destroy the Confederacy. Right, you better go, girl. She lifted her skirts to move forward toward the train, but a man stepped in front of her. He was taller and broader than the ragtag group who had occupied the space before him. He, too, exuded a kind of magnetism, drawing Elle's gaze to him when she should be looking away. His clothing, tight breeches, and a rough-hewn coat suggested he was a dock worker. Ugh. The odor of fish further supported her superstition. The men around him seethed, becoming more riled as they watched the actions of those already attempting to storm the train, and he joined them in their anti-union rants. Oh, Lord, this is too MAGA for me. Anyways, Jeff Davis is the true president, he called over his companion's head. He shifted position to allow her a better view of him. Most of his face was obscured by a heavy black beard that needed trimming, but his eyes were visible. Unlike the other men around him, whose gazes were dark with a kind of feverish mania, his intense blue eyes were clear and attentive as he surveyed the crowd. He seemed of them, but not one of them. Something Elle could pinpoint with accuracy, since she had spent a good portion of her life in just such a position. His head swiveled a bit more and his gaze locked on hers. She froze like a creeping thing that hopes if it doesn't move, it can be go undetected, that which would prey on it. Their gazes held for an infinite moment, and the roar of the crowd faded into the background. A disquiet she'd never known gripped her. The man didn't leer or hurl abuse or look right through her. He saw her, and that was the most dangerous turn of events that could have befallen her. Their stare down was broken when he was jostled by another surge of the crowd, which was slowly but resolutely pushing toward the door of the station. Everything came back into focus, and Elle released the breath that had been caught in her gullet. The soldiers had disembarked and were marching from the station towards the street now, and the angry men searching for targets followed right along. The majority of the regiments who arrived were heading to Fort McHenry, save Biddle's, which was heading to the capital. Elle held many ciphers in her head. The ones she needed to get to Biddle were only a small portion. She couldn't risk passing such information by post, and telegraph lines were down or unsecured. Biddle was the only man present who had sworn the same oath as she, and thus he was the only man she trusted to get the information to the Capitol. Elle slipped out of the station through a side door and pressed along the buildings behind the seething crowd as she tried to follow the path of the regiments. Biddle should have been easy to find, being the only Negro, but in the midst of an unruly mob hurling invectives and the police officers half-heartedly trying to protect the soldiers, it was hard to make him out. The crowd did her work for her. As a group of men split off from the other Penn regiments, she heard one voice and then another. "Nigger, nigger in a uniform." All hell broke loose then, with the barely restrained mob converging on both the regiment and their own city police officers. Fists began to fly, as did bottles, bricks, and anything the incensed men could get their hands on. Elle froze for a minute, fear robbing her of her purpose, and then she remembered her first night of training with the Loyal League. Lavelle had shoved a book entitled The Art of War at her with the command, "Read this tonight. You'll recite it for me word for word in the morning, or you'll return to the North where a woman like you belongs." That he thought it was a difficult task showed his limitations. Not else. In the end, the ancient strategies had proven more useful than anything Lavelle had tried to impress on her. As the rioting men whipped themselves into a fever, it was Sun Tzu's words that spurred her forward. "In the midst of chaos, there is also opportunity." She scurried into the mass of people, her small stature allowing her to slip through the rolling crowd like a sleek catfish through the river grass. Biddle was in her sights, and she aimed straight for him. He turned as she skidded to a halt in front of him. Elle was shocked to discover the man was older than her father. "I see you have traveled far," she said. His reply was quick, given with just a hint of paternal indulgence that he should have annoyed her, but comforted her instead. "I have, and it has been a lonesome road, my child. The task was almost complete. Remember this and pass it on to those who would aid our cause when you reach Washington." 8 to 16 as the crow flies. 30 to 45 as the sun sets. She rushed out, then took his hand and bade him repeat it. She didn't think it took a spectacular memory to remember two short ciphers, but she had no personal reference point given her own stupendous ability. She hoped she was right. "I will see that this gets to Pinkerton's ears," he said, then turned and continued on his regiment. As he walked away, Elle's knees began to shake with relief. She had waited days to complete a mission that had taken perhaps 30 seconds. Biddle was walking ahead of her, and then suddenly he wasn't. He was flat on the ground. Oh, cracky. A deep gash on the side of his head. He'd been felled by one of the bricks that was still being hurled by the secessionist bastards as they rioted. The fear that had stalked Elle her entire mission pounced then, crushing under its weight as she looked his Biddle prone form in disbelief. For a moment, she thought he must be dead. Surely he must. But then he staggered to his feet, looking back at her with dazed eyes before being hustled off by members of his regiment. She snaked her way back into the crowd, heart thumping and lungs finally filling with air. Success. Something akin to a smile tugged at her mouth, but it was just a physical response to the adrenaline and pride that coursed through her veins. She spied an opening in the melee, an alley used by slaves as a shortcut while running errands. It would lead her out to a street that would be free of the vile men who surrounded her now. She almost made it to the alley's opening when a man's grip closed around her arm, tightening like a vice. She tried to pull away, but she could not escape the strength of the grasp. "Why did you run to that man?" The accent was strange, melange of country boy and foreigner, German. The same as so many lower class men as to be unexceptional. She turned and her voice caught in her throat again. It was the blasted dark worker from the train station. How was it that she was invisible to men like him except in the exact moment it would cause her the most trouble? I ran because walking isn't prudent when in the midst of a mob, you fool. Now may release me at once, she demanded before she could stop herself, then growled in agitation. She was supposed to be meek and unassuming if accosted, but her natural inclination got the better of her. It wouldn't be the first time, and if Lavelle got wind of it, he wouldn't be pleased. She modulated her tone to pleading. Please let go, sir. His eyebrows rose, but expression was one of amusement, not anger. Not until you answer me. Either you're an uncommon hussy, hoping to circumvent your competition, or you sought that regiment out with some specific fit purpose. You can tell me now, or I could ask those fellows knocking skulls over yonder for their opinion. Humiliation scalded Elter toes. It wasn't that no one had ever spoken to her that way before. Plenty of people had belittled her in her life, but the insinuating smirk on his face was too much to countenance. She kept her gaze locked with his, but she let it soften just a bit to throw him off kilter. It worked in her favor, not his. The moment she felt his hold give slightly, she jabbed a fist forward, knocking with his side near the kidney. Hitting a white man was dangerous, but no more so than her mission being discovered if she was arrested. He released her in that first split second of surprise, and that was all she needed. She turned and took off. She would outrun him. She would make it back to her safe house. She'd gotten a few feet away when pain exploded at the base of her throat. The tender hollow where the neck meets the clavicle, sharp, slicing heat, and then a jagged chunk of brick tumbled down the front of her dress, edged in red. She couldn't breathe. And when she brought her hand to her neck, blood flowed over her finger. No. Elle prided herself on having never fainted, but the world started to dim around the edges. And although it was a cool spring afternoon, she was sweating like midday on a plantation in Georgia. You dagnabbit wench. Why didn't you just answer the question? A deep, rich voice asked, and her feet were no longer touching the ground, and she couldn't tell if it was because she was passed out or being pushed over. Everything was growing hazy, even the pain at her neck. For a moment, she floated in the nothingness, and then she was crushed against something warm and solid and scented with the tang of the sea. After that, darkness edged in and consume all. When Elle woke, she didn't know where she was or how much time had passed. She was in a dark room lit by the dimmest candle, and she supposed that some would call the hard surface she lay on a bed. There was something at her throat that smelled of hospice. She groaned. Lavelle's face appeared above hers, and although she knew she often vexed him, something awful, his relief upon seeing her awaken was clear. He brought a cup of water to her mouth, and though she wanted to drink like a horse at a trough, he only allowed her a trickle. When she tried to swallow, she was thankful for it. You aren't to speak, he said, before she could ask what had happened and how she ended up in this small churgery. Doctor's order and a blessing for me. What I need from you requires only a nod or a shake, girl. Did you pass the information to Biddle? She nodded, her chin pressing into a poultice that rested on her neck. She kept her gaze averted from his, unable to talk, and not wanting to see his disappointment, his judgment. Excellent, Lavelle said, taking her chin and lifting her face in his direction. His gaze was speculative as he regarded her. I had my doubts, but you just might prove useful to the cause after all. Holy crack-a-moly. So she basically puts her life on the line, and it also looks like that this Lavelle, another kind of patriot, trained her to actually be a spy. But the jig was almost up when she was accosted by the blue-eyed fisherman or man stinking of fish. One may not have had anything to do with other, was probably just a ploy. To offset, just like her. But it does give you a little bit of prelude to what is promising to be an extraordinary book. And I think I was going to do a little bit of reading from all three books, but I think I'm going to just pause there and just do a second reading from the first chapter of this book, because I'm very much interested in seeing who, if the stranger, the blue-eyed stranger, is the one that shot her, and if he's actually also a part of the loyalist resistance. So hang on with me as we both find out this bit of tidbit of information. So the heart wants what the heart wants, and I think never has this been exemplified more so than in Extraordinary Union. And this is my second reading from this, what is becoming in my mind, a pretty extraordinary book. The main heroine, L, is a black female slave operative, because who better in this time to be completely invisible except for a leering Southern senators until she catches a Southern gentleman's eye. And then there is Malcolm, the double agent Pinkerton guard that's also a Abraham Lincoln loyalist. And they meet twice. And it's not lost on me that he was the one that almost killed her and blew her cover in her first ever mission to get a message that would eventually take down another politician and his allies when she first landed in Baltimore. But that's neither here nor there. They meet again on another equally as dangerous mission, as she poses as a slave, a rent-a-slave, essentially, in the home of the Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia, a little bit later on, like 1862 in Virginia. And their interaction again, her life was actually on the line, because even though she technically was a nobody, she basically rubbed the coddled and spoiled Susie Caffrey the wrong way, who is the somewhat, I believe, spinster daughter of Senator Caffrey. And she seeks to basically demean and debase her, and her father has his roving eye also. And he looks at her, has the wife compare her to the stupid next door untrained dog, and then, which ticks her off, Elle off to no bounds, because she can quote, if she had a voice that is, Keats and William Shakespeare, when she knows that little Susie Caffrey is nothing but an empty-headed, spoiled Southern belle. And Malcolm actually knows that. She's basically put in the position to go back into slavery as an operative, to basically listen to as much as she can, to report back, to her Lincoln loyalist crew. And it's all going to come to a peak, because she is given by another loyalist within the kitchen, she's told to meet someone at an appointed place to get a package that's supposed to actually help the loyalist cause. I think that's when they're going to make their acquaintance and realize that they're fighting on the same side. But something is also going to happen because the Caffreys are going to have a completely socially tone-deaf ball to celebrate the new year when most of Richmond is starving and the South is starving because they're ill-prepared for a war that's actually going to stretch out into another couple of years. But being the stupid people that they are, of course, they don't see that. So it's sure. He is trying to take his leave. To get out and to meet this other unknown operative who is going to turn out, I'm sure, to be L. But here we go. "I have business to attend to," he said gently. "As much as I dislike it, this war won't resolve itself, and there's always something that can be done for the Confederacy. May I call on you tomorrow?" He let his gaze linger on Susie, the empty-headed simpleton. "Yes, of course you can," Senator Caffrey said, standing to shake Malcolm's hand and walk him to the door. "Ansem, get this man his coat," he said to a lean gray haired slave as he stepped into the hallway. The man hurried away, and when Malcolm's gaze followed him, he was met with a sight that made his heart thump out of sync. The slave woman stood with him, with her back to them, polishing the wooden banister of the grand staircase outside the dining room as if it were the most important task in the world. "El, what are you still doing here, girl?" Senator Caffrey said. "Get on back to town before you set Susie off again, and if your master asks why you've been docked half day's wages, mayhap I won't tell him it's because you nearly killed my daughter." Yeah, that stupid girl. "L," Malcolm thought as she nodded and walked towards the kitchens, her gaze trained on the floor. Malcolm knew that slaves weren't paid, but that she'd be forced to report back on wages she would never have seen anyway, and punished for their loss seemed even more despicable. "She doesn't live here?" Malcolm asked. "No, she lives in a colored rooming house on the other side of town where some of the hideout darkies stay. I send her wages to her master." The practice always seemed to surprise him. There had been a time when he wondered why slaves didn't just run away once they were out of their master's view, but he knew now that family ties, fear of the unknown, and harsh runaway slave laws made it all but impossible for most slaves to make the attempt. Caffrey continued, "We're renting her while we're here in town since we left most of our help back on our plantation. But my wife doesn't like to keep the pretty ones around at night, lest I go a-wandering." Like it's okay to go, her husband to go a-raping in the slave quarters. How disgusting. Senator Caffrey elbowed him congenially as if they were old friends, raising his chin in Elle's direction. "Can you imagine having that under you and her not able to make a sound?" Malcolm feigned amusement and elbowed Caffrey back, perhaps slightly harder than was acceptable. Ansem's arrival with his overcoat saved him from answering the despicable question. "I'll see you tomorrow, Senator." He left the man leering down the hallway and went to the stable. He paced as the boy prepared his horse, a strange melancholy hanging over him. When Malcolm rode off, his mind was whirling with emotions he needed to categorize and file away, lest they undo him. He was behind enemy lines and trying to ingratiate himself to as many of the Confederate establishments as he could. Getting angry over everyday occurrences like a downtrodden slave and a master who lusted after her wouldn't help anything. But, of course, because he's an upstanding guy, he couldn't reason away the raw frustration at the way Caffrey had so blithely mentioned taking advantage of the woman. Malcolm didn't think Elle was simple, but Senator Caffrey and his family did, and still the man dreamt of forcing himself on her just because he could. White privilege gone wild. Or supremacy gone wild. Rape was a sin, and as it was subjugating other human beings. Malcolm's mind got muddled with anger, thinking of how in these lands, institutionalized sin was seen as a way of life and needed defending. Leave me be, or at least have the decency to send my boy away. A plaintive voice from years gone by and leagues away rang in his mind that the gang of English dogs had followed the second request, but ignored the first, had changed the course of Malcolm's life. The act of violence had planted a seed of malevolence that had eventually grown to rip his family apart. It was one of the many injustices that wouldn't allow him to stand idly by in this war. That makes me think that one of his female family members, or probably more likely his mother, was raped with him right in front of her by the English soldiers, because he was originally from Scotland. How disgusting. People in power doing shitty shit. He was about to push his horse into a gallop to outrace the unwanted memory when he saw a figure walking up ahead along the dusty rutted road, a too thin cloak draped over about her shoulders as she hunched through the cold wintry evening. There was no question of who it was or of whether speaking to her was the exact opposite of what he should do. Still, he slowed as he approached her. Miss L, her name on his lips felt familiar and right. Her head whipped up, but her face was unreadable. The late day sun highlighted her cheekbones and the smooth darkness of her skin. It reminded him of the newly tilled soil after spring rain, fresh and sweet. Her eyebrows rose and he realized he was delaying her from wherever she was going. Maybe she had a husband waiting at a rooming house for her or visiting from a plantation. To Malcolm's consternation, he found that possibility didn't sit well with him at all. I wanted to give you my apologies again for today. I fall on my sword before hurting a woman that way. Any woman. Her lips parted in surprise, sending a rush of want through him even as he apologized for it. But Malcolm had experienced lascivious thoughts before, and that wasn't what this woman inspired him. He prided himself on his careful deliberation, but words were spilling out before he realized his mouth was moving. I won't lie. I teased you earlier because I think you're beautiful. Maybe the loveliest woman I've ever clapped eyes on, but it was wrong of me to frighten you. I'll be coming and going at the house over the next few days. He saw the wariness creep into her eyes and raised a hand to allay her suspicions. And I want you to know you're safe in my presence. Senator Caffrey's leering gaze cropped up in his mind's eye. And you're safe from any other unwanted advances, too. If you see fit to let me know, no one will harm you while I'm there. Here, it's not much of an offer, but I'll do what I can. Good day, Miss L. And with that, he rode off towards his hotel, leaving her standing on the side of the road with a shocked expression on her face. His heart was nearly beating out of his chest, as if she were the first woman he'd ever spoken to. It was a risk to speak so to a slave, but for reasons he couldn't quite understand, he needed her to know he'd protect her if he had to. Nearly every aspect of his life was a lie. His job changed from town to town, as did his hair color, social status, accent, and loyalty. But that was one thing he needed to be true, and perhaps not just for her benefit. If someone understood that bit of truth about Malcolm McCall, maybe he wouldn't fade away into the mist as the roles he played became ever larger and more dangerous. If he died in Richmond, there would be one person who'd know he wasn't exactly who he seemed to be, and her name was Elle. He was glad of that. In any event, she was mute. It wasn't as if she could tell anyone she found him strange. Oh, really, bro? So I'm going to pause there before I go on to chapter 3. That's the way chapter 2 actually ends. And This is, again, as I said, this is turning out to be quite the page turner. Unlikely, not only unlikely allies, but unlikely love interests in a very turbulent and in a time. And when you think about it, it's all pretty much surreal, because even after the war, they couldn't get married, because I'm not sure of when the miscegenation laws came into effect, but it would be illegal for them to actually have a union. I don't know. Maybe because he was one of the founding fathers, but the whole Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson relationship was basically still a slave owner and his slave. I don't recall hearing or reading anything about them that you talk about being unequally yoked. He actually was still married, although his wife was crazy. I don't know if they ended up, or she ended up getting poisoned or whatever, but and dying. But she basically died in a lunatic's asylum, I think. I'm not sure if he ever married Sally Hemings, whether in France, but I don't think it was legal for him to even, or if she was even recognized as his wife, or any of his children were actually recognized as legitimate. As was the tradition of the time, they would adopt the names of their owners, who very well could have been their parent. But even though Malcolm McCall seems to be a pretty stand-up Scotsman, the disparity and the unequalness of this union, even though they have similar ideas, I don't know if love can really conquer all, or they would be definitely not be protected from the ridicule that permeated during this very disgusting period in our history of the country. But even in spite of it, you still really, it just goes to prove that you can't control love, and you can't control what the heart wants. I think it's admirable that a woman is writing this part in the honorability of a man that maybe, is it possible? I don't know. But at this particular time, it's like a needle in a haystack. Finding someone with the ideas that looks at this young woman as a love interest, even though it would never be accepted in society, and it would be illegal if they were to even have an honorable union. It's crazy that the society at that time would protect the subjugation of a race and the institutionalized raping of women of color. And that's what they fought. That's what they were fighting that war for. It's okay to subjugate and enslave a whole race of people and treat them worse than the neighbor's goofy ass dog. And that's what they were that's in a nutshell what the war, when you boil it down, that's what that war was fought for, with all its implications. Absolutely disgusting. However, that is why I think drove him that in its purest form, not any other race deserved that type of treatment. It's wrong. And he was a one-man SWAT team. And he also found it that whatever he could do to dismantle the slave states, as well as protect Abraham Lincoln, who also was a man who was also flawed. But that's
besides the point, and it's a distraction from the love story that is actually taking place right in the middle of a war that could have torn apart this country. So what or how do you propose single people should actually spend their holidays? As an aggressively and annoyingly single middle-aged woman, I never look forward to Valentine's Day. And I think one of my cousins has the distinction of being born on that day. Yeah, I'm like, whatever. This is the first year, I think, I've done Valentine's Day the way, what makes me happy during Valentine's Day. I'm planning to have a really good meal. I'm actually on the coast of Mississippi right now. It's been kind of rainy and cloudy all week long. And of course it's going to, clear up on Valentine's Day as I record and publish and edit my podcast. But, that's all good. Getting up in the morning, having a great breakfast, and just do what I like to do. Read what I like to read and what makes me happy. And this historical romance fiction is right up there. I'm going to add some more of these books to my bookstore, Chatterbooks. Check it out, because there are gift cards available, Star Trek swag, as well as the books that I've actually been talking about or going to be reading from my next several podcasts. Also, navigate to shipabagofdicks.com. Get someone either a bag of gummy penises or a 6-foot chocolate penis. You can send it anonymously, or I'm sure you just, or you could just text the intended receiver and let them know that a penis is coming to them in a unmarked package. So there you go. And I'll also have many of the coupons to get up to 20 to maybe even $30 off of your order by using the Alibris.com coupon codes. And all of those details will be in the full podcast notes. I just realized how I actually want to actually create the podcast notes on my Dale's Angels Inc. blog. Not only can you get the full details of this particular podcast, but you can actually search through and look at my other Over 40 and Unapologetically Nerdy to find out everything you want about NASA news and the SpaceX program. And this is how I wanted to end it. I wanted to end this with highlights, talking about books, and just sharing with you how you can actually be entertained and you can educate yourself and you can actually be happy in your singleness, even as if you're widowed, even if you're contemplating divorce. Being connected to something or to someone is how we're going to get through these difficult times, and keeping your mind engaged is how you won't lose it. Until next time, and as always, thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I've enjoyed creating it. Bye, y'all.